Hello, welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius, your host today, Darius Nomdaron, and today I've got a fascinating guest. She has been a marketing consultant for 20 years, helping mission-shaped, mission-driven businesses get their story out and tell their story and change lives, all sorts of different companies and organizations. She's also a mother of two dyslexic kids and married to a dyslexic husband. So she has a dyslexia story to tell. In fact, what she did was a year and a half ago, drop all her work and channel all of those skills and abilities to help progress the dyslexia story. And so she wrote a book, took 6 months writing it, interviewed 200 different people and published this book. And I'd like to introduce you to Mickey Boaz. Welcome, Mickey. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Darius.
Have I pronounced your name correctly, your surname? I didn't ask.
Yes, correct. Mickey Boaz.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really great to have you here. When does this book get published, by the way?
It actually was published last week, so we are in the second week of excitement. It came out on August 11th on Simon & Schuster.
Hot off the press. Brilliant. So you're here. I want to hear your story, and I think you've got a fascinating story to tell. And as always in Dyslexia Explored, we like to go back to the beginning and hear the story from where it all began and see where the turning points and moments were for you. So where did it all start for you?
Yes. So I actually grew up in Florida and I struggled with attention issues myself. And I went to progressive schools. My mom's a speech therapist. So that's kind of my personal journey. But I was always taught to fight from a very young age, raised by strong women. And that's kind of driven me throughout my life. My husband grew up in Argentina in the 70s. And he's dyslexic, a creative photographer, entrepreneur, business owner, and we met in Coney Island many years ago. And what attracted me to him was his passion, his big picture ability, and I didn't know when I met him that he was dyslexic. And so it wasn't until we had children, I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, that we realized that exactly what my husband's struggles were. So I noticed this with many people I spoke with, that they don't realize that they're dyslexic until they start to see some of the similar struggles in their children. So my oldest son, he missed all of the classic milestones. He walked late, he talked late, he didn't progress developmentally as other children did. And I was in denial for a very long time. I was in denial because I knew that there was going to be a tough road ahead for him. And I just felt that the more I could let it be, the more time I had to ignore it. And in hindsight, it was a really bad decision. I'm really lucky that my husband and my mom were both vocal advocates in making me wake up to the fact that I needed to address some of these challenges. In the U.S., we have something called early intervention. So before the age of 3, you're able to get services to help your child. And so, but yet 90% of the U.S. doesn't know that these services exist. Yeah, go ahead.
Before the age of 3?
Yes. So under the IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Act, there's a section called Part C, and that's for early intervention. And there's money given by the federal government to provide services before 3, because your brain is developing and it's almost seen as like a preventative cost for special education, because you can bring in play therapy. My son actually qualified for speech therapy, but the average pediatrician visit in the US is 10 minutes. And so how are you able to kind of have these conversations about those early years, and how are they supposed to keep you aware about early intervention when the visits are so short? So my mom actually coached me on how to qualify for earlier intervention. So imagine that, Darius, like my mom coaching me on how to get government services. There's a problem. There's a problem.
So what was your mother's background and how could she do that?
So my mom's a speech therapist for 20 years. She had her own practice in Florida. She was, grew her practice out to serve many different children and many different
people. Okay. So speech therapists often have, you know, like often if you've got visual problems like reading, you go to the ophthalmologist, and other times you go to the speech therapist, and these are both often the gatekeepers or the first people you meet when you're having these kind of classic dyslexic challenges in the early years. So help the listeners get a gauge of the age stage. So you were putting it off, and how old was your son?
We got him in under the buzzer. So he had 6 months of 3 months of services. It took us a while to qualify. But he had 3 months of services before he was not eligible anymore. So, yes.
So 2.5 to 3 years old. That's how old he was.
Yes.
Mickey, you're talking about you kind of left it a bit and you feel bad about it. Most parents listening to this be saying, I kind of left it for a bit and I feel bad about it, when their child's like 8 or 9 or 10.
Right. Well,
they're 3.
The story continues, because that to me was just, you know, forming the sounds, making sure his mouth was working. Those are kind of some of the perfunctory basic skills. But I still was in denial, just because he qualified for early intervention didn't mean that I was still fully on board. I'll tell you about the moment when I officially had to get on board. So he went to a private preschool where they didn't sound any alarms. Although parents, if you come out of an early intervention program and enter school, that should be a warning sign or a caution sign to the educators to make sure that they're giving your child what they need, but it wasn't the case. And then he was in a Montessori type of school, which I typically see work for learners like myself and my husband, where the child is like leading. And that was a hard, he thrived emotionally and socially there, but they didn't want to tell us that there was issues either. It wasn't until like my mom was actually pushing for a reading test for them to actually tell us there might be a reading program. But the unfortunate part about private schools in the US is that they don't have to serve our children. So we had to pay privately for speech. We had to pay privately for occupational therapy. It was conveniently located on the campus of the school, and they should have provided the resources that we needed, but you know, the support just isn't there in the private schools. And so we were lucky enough to get him into a charter school in our neighborhood in the end of kindergarten, the beginning of first grade. And so that was the actual wake-up call for me, when his teacher pulled me aside on day 2 and's like, your son is nowhere near where a first grader, you know, a rising first grader should be. And still in denial, I was like, well, it's because he came from a progressive school and it was private. And so they let him skip and actually not skip. They didn't hold him back, because as you know, to me, holding a child back is not, in my personal opinion, is not the answer. I think it's the responsibility of the schools to step up and educate your child no matter where they are. And so he entered the first grade, and in the first grade, that's when the fight began. I saw where the other kids were, and I saw where my son was, and there was no more denying it. He was struggling.
When you say saw, were you one of these parents who kind of goes in and volunteers and you can see the parent? Because we've had a few podcasts where that was the wake-up call, where the parents see it side by side. And actually during COVID, often parents are seeing things that they were hidden behind the classroom door. So when you say saw, what do you mean?
Yeah, so it's really not my MO to be a class parent. I'm not necessarily a Judy Joyner or somebody that is taking on that role, but because of the concerns I had about my child, I took on that role. So yes, I physically saw it in class. I saw it hanging up on the bulletin boards. I saw what they were, asking us to do for homework, and it was taking us like almost 4 hours to do first grade homework. And that to me was the sign that there was a problem. And so I was able to get the school to do the testing, which in a lot of the stories I've encountered is not the case, but we were lucky with that. But in the US, testing and evaluation can almost take up 2/3 of the school year. So it wasn't until February that we were able to get the diagnosis. So I thought that the diagnosis would open up the red carpet and world of possibilities ahead for my child. But boy, was I wrong. He was receiving 30 minutes of the reading system that he needed a week in first grade. And I don't know for your listeners, but you know, if you were told you could only put on your glasses to see 30 minutes a week in first grade, that's insane to me. And so I used my big mouth and my advocacy skills to ask for more. And here's where the crux of the story lies. I asked for more. I said, why can't I have more than 30 minutes? We don't have availability. They had one reading specialist in the whole school. So of course they don't have availability if 20% of the population is dyslexic in the school. How are they going to be able to have that, right? So I asked if I could bring in my tutor. I asked if I could come early. I asked for a million possibilities, and the answer was always no, 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 no. And so I felt backed up against a wall. And when I'm backed up against a wall, I try to tell a compassionate story. I try to become innovative and find a way out. It just wasn't working. And so that's when I started to learn that they just didn't have my child's best interests at heart. And I had to start seeking lawyers to help me advocate for my cause.
So you legaled up. What happened next then? So basically what you've got is you and your son enter into the school system. A teacher wakes you up, which is fantastic. And yet the school system itself resists you. Instead of the red carpet, you find red tape.
Oh yes.
And then you started to legal up to try and deal with this red tape. So what happened next?
Yeah. So to me, that is where the invisible red tape really like wraps around you and threatens to mummify you and keep you silent, because you have no idea what you're dealing with the schools. But basically, you have to be almost 2.5 deviants behind the rest of the class in order to be given the help that I thought my son deserved. So I was really trying to work with the school to give him everything they needed, but it was clear the teacher had 30 hours of training in the most basic level of OG. I literally found her one day copying and pasting boards off of Pinterest that was considered multisensory learning. You know, it was subpar. And so the answers they were giving me were not enough. And so I had to up the level. And for me, it was a lawyer. And so when the lawyer told me that I wanted to put my son in an environment where he could learn, and I felt that it was the right of myself and of the school district that I'm in to pay for that. And if they didn't want to work with me, then they should show me the other options. I was happy to go to a public school. I was happy to go to another school that could provide the resources. And I searched around and I saw a private school that was a dream, a language-based learning school for children with disabilities. But the cost of this school is the cost of a college education per year. So my husband and I are two freelancers, and that was a very scary, you know, undertaking to think about. But I thought that I had a strong case and that I could find a way to get him there. But boy, are the laws set up against you, and they are set up in favor of the school. It's an opaque and obstructionist, you know, process that I had to go through. But the schools have a legal policy that allows them to litigate without paying any costs. And I'm paying, you know, and enter New York City lawyer cost here. And we didn't win. So it took me 4 years, 4 lawyers and 4 school formats to finally get my son into a place that he can thrive.
My goodness. So you lost the first time?
Yeah, so
you lost the second time, mm-hmm. you lost the third time, and then mm-hmm. the fourth time you were successful.
Yeah. I mean, wow. we didn't go to court during all of those lawyers, but each lawyer I would go to, I was basically looking for a different way to innovate, a different way to find a way for my son to learn in the way that his brain worked. And so it was finally the fourth lawyer that we made it to court, and actually had a meeting with the judge because I just felt so defeated. My lawyer asked me, do you want to talk to the judge and see if there's anything you can say? And I did. And I write about this in the book, but I asked her, like, how is this legal? Like, how are you telling me that I have to allow my son to lock himself in a bathroom and commit, you know, have such emotional damage before they will provide the resources to send my son to a school? And she's like, that's just how it works, you know, that's just the system. And he's not far enough behind to, you know, offer. And imagine being a mom told that your child's not far enough behind, but he can't read at the level, and you've been fighting for 4 years. So I stood outside a courtroom in Newark and cried myself to sleep for a couple of days. And then I started fighting again. So the judge told me that my best option to find, to get him the education he deserved was to look to the public school, because charter schools are severely underfunded in comparison to charter schools. I'm sorry, in comparison to public schools. So
can you explain to our international audience and maybe even parents in America who don't understand the difference, what mm-hmm. is a charter school, what is a public school, and what is a private school?
Yes, okay. So a public school is fully funded from the tax dollars of your district, depending on what zip code you live in. That's the main problem with education, is how well and how good your schools are funded. And so the public school is run by the Board of Education, and they are their own entity, and that is who you have to answer to. There's a Board of Education, and everything is run and understood under the public school system. In a charter school, it is run by what they call a local education authority. So in the case of my son's charter school, that was parents who were volunteering to be on the board to run the public school, to run the charter school. And they receive a portion of the public school funding because they are not asked to transport them, feed them. Oh no, I think they have to feed them. They're not asked to transport them, and they're not asked to do a few other things. So that is the rationale of why they receive less money. And private schools receive a very small portion of money from the public schools. I could be wrong there, but when it comes to like evaluating children for special needs, there's like a few slots and a few kind of places that are able to be filled in my opinion. So for example, in my district, we're $155 million underfunded, right? And it costs twice as much to educate a child with special needs as it does a child who's neurotypical. So imagine like the whole crux of the problems, and the crux of the problems I saw when I went to the public school, is that they don't want to screen. They don't want to give the support they need because there's simply not enough money there. I don't believe that the charter school had ill intentions. I don't think any parent should have to talk to four lawyers to get an education, you know, for their children. But when the money's not there, they're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that they don't have to give your child what they deserve.
Now, this might be stating the obvious here, Mickey, and if there's parents listening to this that will understand what you're talking about, and there's other parents who are like, other people listening, you know, when you're talking about an education for my child, you know, what do you picture as the education your child needs and why it's important for them? Because sometimes we say this word, oh, our children need an education, and we think back to our school ages and you think, I'm not sure how much school was good for me because, you know, I didn't get much of it, or much of it stick, or whatever. You know, so different people have a different sort of definition of what education is and the value of the education for your child. So from your personal point of view, what did you see you wanted? What did you have your eye on? And what did you see happening to your son in comparison?
Yeah. So after research and lawyers and all the amazing advocacy groups on Facebook, I learned that my son needs a multi-sensory learning system that's phonics-based with frequency and a trained teacher. And I don't think that that is an outrageous request. I think that that's something that should be built into the education systems today, but only 4 out of 10, you know, teacher training programs actually teach the science of reading. And so it puts us at an extreme disadvantage to expect teachers to come with the skills they need, to expect the number of time and frequency that's needed for dyslexic brains to learn. And so that's what I mean when I say that that's the education that I feel that my child deserved. And so,
yeah. And what did you see in comparison? How was he experiencing it? How old was he at this stage? And what was his experience in contrast?
Yeah. So, you know, he was kind of bullied in the school. He was called the Statue of Liberty for holding his hand up too long, asking for help.
My goodness. The Statue of Liberty.
Yes. Yes. He was called the Statue of Liberty for holding his hand up too much. And so I saw the effects that the school was having on him. And one of, I guess, the good things of meeting all these people along the journey is I found the Craig School, which is a language-based learning, a school for language-based learning differences. That's an hour from our house. And once I saw that, I had my eyes set. It was from the moment you walked into the door, they had an FM system so he could block out the noise for his attention issues. They had an hour and a half every day of multi-sensory reading by super amazing Orton Gillingham trained teachers. They taught science through putting your hands in the ground and composting. I mean, that was the Cadillac of education, and I wish everyone had access to it.
Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that with Nikki. And so what happened next? So you said the fourth time it worked. What happened? What was the reward for the fourth time? It didn't work.
We just hit a roadblock, and I had a tough decision to make. I could keep fighting and bankrupt my family even further, right? Or I could take a loss and just put my child into this private school in second grade and teach him the right way the first time. Because I'm sure you know, as you've heard from your guests, remediating and trying to teach the right way the second time is much harder on your self-esteem. And that's the decision that my husband and I made, was like, the emotional damage that would happen was not something that we were willing to risk. So we served them a 10-day notice at the middle of second grade. When his teacher didn't show up for 3 months giving him Orton Gillingham support, and we put him in the Craig School, and he's been there ever since.
Okay, I get it now.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices.
So you had this dilemma that every parent has, you know, fight the system and change it or sidestep it.
Yeah.
And you basically tried to fight it for those 4 years and 4 lawyers. And then in the end, you said it's time to sidestep it and pay instead.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And I sidestepped it because I was lucky, pure luck, pure, you know, determination to find a way for my son. And that's why I want to innovate and figure out other ways that our children can get that support earlier and faster. And that was the main purpose of writing this book. And actually, while I was writing this book, I had to fight a second school for my younger son for his issues. So can you imagine? It was like Groundhog's Day. I'm in the middle of like almost on an interview 100, and we had kept the eye off of my little guy, and then up comes the problems with him. And I was like, So hopefully this book will create change and a way for parents to get what they need quicker and faster.
How much did it cost you for those 4 years, if you don't mind saying?
Oh, my husband says that we could have bought the lawyer a few boats.
A few boats?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, you know, could you have sent your child to the private school for those 4 years for the same price it cost to do the lawyer?
It was about the equivalent of 1 year. So
1 year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But this is a long battle. So my son's been there for 4 years and you have one chance to fight the schools. So I was giving it everything that I had in order to fight for him. And quite honestly, I think they fought so hard against me because they wanted to make an example of me. I had a big mouth, and if they let me through, imagine the 20% of the rest of the school they have to deal with. Yeah.
Yes. So they have to knock that head down so that the breach, the flood, it doesn't flood. So he's in this great school, and tell us about the book.
Yeah. So I decided to write the book after my post-traumatic stress of those 4 years kicked in. I started to go around and talk with other parents. Like, am I the only person that is experiencing this? And that's when I found great groups like Decoding Dyslexia, the International Dyslexia Association. I realized, wow, this is a big problem. This is not just me. And so as a storyteller, I started having some conversations wondering why we're in the situation that we're in. And as a curious person, I wanted to discover that. And I started speaking with as many people as I could. And Simon & Schuster was interested in going on this journey with me. And so one of their missions is to try to bring books to light quicker and faster so that they're relevant by the time that you read them. And so that's kind of how we structured the book. This was my gift to the community, because I wish I would have known some of the things earlier I wish I would have known some of these things earlier and faster, because I think that it would have provided greater results. Like I learned so much more from the Facebook groups than I ever learned from the professionals. And so I went out to the Facebook communities and we got over, you know, so many responses of people wanting to tell their stories. And my story is just one, as you know, in a million stories. And so there's 19 women featured in the book, and we talk about the outrageous obstacles they go through. And then we also talk about the solution section on how to fix things.
So you talked about three issues that you started to see in the book, and you share three issues in the book. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah. So I think the biggest problem that we face is, first of all, the federal laws are not set up to support dyslexic learners, right? So for your audience, I'm sure they know the Individuals with Disabilities Act that was passed almost 47 years ago. It guarantees that they will fill in the financial gap between neurotypical learners and those with special needs. And so the federal government has never funded anywhere near the 40% that they have promised. On a good year, they funded 15%. So the trickle-down effect to the state and local governments is immense. Like I mentioned, my district is $155 million underfunded. How are you going to be able to have the financial means to serve my children? So the number one reason that I uncovered for why we're in this national education crisis is funding. So, you know, a way that some of the stories that I uncovered in the book around funding is I spoke with a mom in Iowa. She's a single mom raising her daughter, and she had to choose between taking her heart medicine or providing a dyslexic tutor for her child. But yet when she asked the school about funding, she saw in the football stadium high-tech screens, but yet they couldn't give her daughter any more of the time that she needed, and her health was at stake when it came to the financial ramifications. Another woman I spoke to in the book, her child was autistic, and they refused to see his dyslexic needs because they got more money for an autism diagnosis than they did a dyslexia diagnosis. So I think one of the things that we can do to begin thinking about how to fix these underfunding problems is, in the States, it's election time in November, and your Congress people, your Senate people, all the way up, if you tell your personal stories to them as a constituent, they are able to speak with on your behalf to fully fund IDEA and not leave the burden on our state and local governments and fulfill the needs that they promised almost 45 years ago.
Well, the burden isn't just transferred to state and local governments. It's actually also to parents. Mm-hmm. You know, as you very well know and are saying, you know, the burden is being transferred onto state and local, but a huge amount of it is onto parents to supplement with home teaching, to learn Ort and Gillingham themselves and teach themselves the Barton method, or pay for private tutors and so on. And that's just, you know, the half of it. I mean, each parent, I think in the UK, they did a survey of, you know, thousands of the parents with dyslexia about the emotional ramifications of dyslexia. And a huge outcome was, like, I think 90% of the children and the parents were ashamed of being dyslexia. And we talked about shame in the Stan Gloss interview. And we know that through Brené Brown, the costs of shame, the hiding that's required, and also the system forcing you to hide, as it were. But in addition to that, they found out that on average, the typical household with a dyslexic kid's paying an extra $1,500 to $2,000 a year on average across them all. And so, you know, that's it. When you get an average, then you've got parents who are paying, you know, 10,000 and others who are paying, you know, 100 a year. There's a whole range, but that's a very high average extra burden on the parents.
Yeah. And what happens to people who can't pay for that? That's what really scares me. I mean, there's a study out of Northwestern that showed the cost to society of a dropout in the US is $292,000.
So, how did they figure that out?
I can give you the reference to the study, but they basically, the cost of food stamps, welfare, imprisonment, education, all of these things came into account. And so, you know, there was a great post on some of the blogs recently that an ounce of prevention is actually pays out in gold in the end. And, you know, we see that immensely. And there's also a woman did a TED talk talking about the cost to get a dyslexic child through high school was $400,000. So private schools, tutors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So to what you're basically saying for the listeners is the actual cost to deliver the education and supplement it for the whole of the 7 years of high school, is it 8 years of high school, is 400 grand, which is about 50 grand a year.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the costs are a small part of it, because if the government was doing its job and actually provided the funding that we need, we wouldn't be in this situation. Because the number one thing that I uncovered in my book is that we don't want to look at the problem. Because if we looked at it, we'd actually have the need to have the resources. And especially in COVID, like people, a friend of mine is an administrator in the Chicago public school system. And he said to me, Mickey, I barely have enough money to feed them and get them to school. How am I going to educate your child when he gets there? So that's why, you know, so it's a real question.
It's interesting. I mean, talking personally, as listeners know, I run a company called Bullet Map Academy, and we tutor dyslexic children online, tutoring for dyslexic children study skills, so kids can actually enjoy school with the right skill set and stay in school. But we're learning how to teach them these visual study skills when they're younger and younger, because it's harder to teach younger children visual study skills. It takes more skill to teach a younger child a skill than a teenager or an adult. And at one point I stopped and I thought to myself, how many study skills tutors would you need to give a 9-year-old or 10-year-old dyslexic kid half an hour tutoring a week for 1 year to teach them a visual way to study, which is not a huge amount. Okay.
I have a number for you.
I'll share the number that I've got. I came up with 1,000. No, what was it? Was it 1,000? No, it's 10,000 full-time tutors to teach them online for half an hour a week for 1 year to a 10-year-old. It would take 10,000 tutors just to deliver that small aspect of what a visual thinker like a dyslexic kid needs to understand. What number did you come up with?
So it's kind of the other two issues I wanted to talk about, but was like early intervention and teacher training. So
yes,
here's two interesting numbers. The cost of one lawsuit, you could train 6 teachers. So the emphasis and the brute they put behind fighting you, they could actually have 6 teachers trained in a school. So my younger son has 600 kids in the school and 1 reading specialist. So imagine how they could get ahead of it with that. Also, I spoke with the IMSE and they showed to train the staff, it cost $14 per child in the school. So $14 to have a trained Orton-Gillingham multisensory instructor. I mean, $14 per student. I mean,
Well, when you think about your, when you do the numbers in America, the UK, Australia, but America, they're massive. It's like billions of pounds when you're talking about dyslexic kids' educations. Billions when you're talking 10% of the population minimum needing these sorts of interventions.
Yeah. And to me, go ahead. And yeah, then
I'm very keen to go through the three issues. So the summarize them for me.
Is early intervention. So the first point was, the reason I think we are in this national education crisis is because of the lack of funding, number one, the lack of early intervention, and the lack of teacher training. So let's talk about the lack of early intervention. I know we talked about your audience has older children, but the average age that you can accurately diagnose dyslexia at 5, only 6% in the U.S. are diagnosed with dyslexia at 6, and 40% are diagnosed at 10. And the average proficient reader, as you know, should be proficient around 7. So we are diagnosing our children 3 years too late. And to me, the critical number, if you only remember one thing, is that if you are not reading by the end of third grade, you are 4 times more likely to drop out of high school. 4 times more likely to drop out of high school. So,
and the impact of that to a family is just massive. How many... You know, I mean, I can just picture it and I see it. You know, you've got a teenager who drops out of high school. You worry as parents. The child needs help. The child starts to feel embarrassed and shamed. They start putting up the bravado. They start turning to things that can cover up that embarrassment and shame: drink, drugs, aggression, you know, criminality, whatever. You know, 40% of people in jail are dyslexic, you know. Yeah. You know, we talk about the entrepreneurs, 30 to 40% of them are dyslexic, but there's a heck of a lot more dyslexics in jail than are millionaires.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's two sides. We are people of extremes. With dyslexia, we've got extremely skilled and specialized minds. But we can go to extremes, both in life trajectories and dropping out as a school. I know as a parent of a 20-year-old's dyslexics now, we're a bit further on in the journey, you know, it affects the way you organize. It's like, you know, I see 5 things, it affecting 5 things. Your reading, your writing, your remembering, your tests and then you're planning. And they map out to the stages of life as well. So in the early years, you know, 7 to 9, it's all the reading. And then it's all the writing, the story writing, the comprehension in the 8 to 10, 12s. Then you've got the remembering of, you know, remembering tests and producing things for smaller tests. And then you've got the actual tests and exams that hit you in the later teens and so on, and showing what you know and proving what you know. And then in your 18, 20s, you've got the planning, you know? And so each one of those are chances where dyslexia gets in the way. And even as a parent who knows about dyslexia myself and understands it and teaches it, it's still a huge challenge, and there's risks that you get waylaid and distracted from your mission and your passion and your joy of life. So back to what you were saying is...
And so that third grade threshold is really critical. I have a son that's about to enter third grade, and we are struggling with him. And I really believe that's a critical age. And especially in this moment of COVID, 2/3 of children with learning disabilities do not get diagnosed and the support and help that they need. And so this early intervention is the second point of my book, is super critical. My advice to parents is, if you think there's something going on, write a note to your teachers, speak up now, because it's within your rights to be screened and evaluated. And, you know, not Dr. Nadine Gabb and all of those people who are doing amazing work in early intervention, you can, I think at-risk readers, when given the support and frequency they need, can read at grade level somewhere between 56 and 92%. I really think that we have to stop, you know, turning our heads the other way because the funding isn't there, and identify these children early, because the results are fantastic when you do. So that's the second point of the book. And I interviewed some moms that were denied this early intervention. One from a woman in North Carolina. She was told that her son didn't qualify in all different types of ways. She finally had to take it to the almost highest court in North Carolina. And then when he was already in a private school, they dumped like 3 years worth of services on her desk and said that she had to like bring them to her son after hockey practice and his private school if she wanted to get it. I mean, could you have such a backward system, like fight for 3 years and then get dumped 3 year services back on your child who's already, you know, three years ahead? Another woman was told that she tried to bring in services to help because they wouldn't diagnose her child. She actually found a way to bring a tutor to the library during lunch. And so she got other parents to write a letter and send their kids to lunch. And she brought in a private reading tutor that she had to pay for. And she had to rent the room from the school because it was considered a liability to get their child a trained teacher in the early years so that they didn't have to face what was going to happen. And the principal told her, if I have to bring in a reading tutor to teach your child how to read, I have to bring in a gymnastics tutor for those who can't do gymnastics well. So she was, the principal of this school was comparing reading to sports.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So early intervention is critical so that we don't end up having to pay for a school room and, you know, fight to get our kids what they need. And that's actually the fight that I had with my second son. They refused to diagnose him as dyslexic, and I had to fight 18 months on that battle just to get the diagnosis, to get him the help they need. And that's my number one piece of advice for early intervention, is to let data rule your storytelling, because data makes it not emotional. So they denied my son early intervention by 1 point on the cutoff line. He didn't qualify. But when I actually dug in, he, you know, the range of scoring was almost 20 points and he was 1 point away. He wasn't at the bottom of the range. He was 1 point from qualifying. He could have had a bad day. He could have had an empty stomach. Who knows? And so that was the reason they denied him. And so my advice on early intervention is, see the data. Tell me why you're denying me. Tell me why you're not giving me the support in numbers. Oh, he's out of range. he's not reading at, he's reading just fine. Well, where is just fine? Show me the numbers. Show me where the rest of the school is playing out, right? And yeah. So that's one of the biggest pieces of advice I think is important in early intervention.
We've got this huge crisis in schools, underfunded. They're not identifying early enough. So what it does is it makes the problem even worse in later years with huge dropouts in high school. I think 40% of dropouts in high school are dyslexic.
Yep.
Am I right? What range?
There,
it's somewhere around about that.
Yeah, there's so many different numbers. That sounds right. That sounds right to me. Yeah.
40% ends up being the magic number with dyslexics and entrepreneurs, prison time, dropouts, and so on. And anyway, third point is teacher education.
Yeah, it's teacher
Tell us
training.
About that so, in America.
So to me, like, okay, your child, you finally have your child diagnosed, which again, I said, I thought would be the red carpet in both my children's situation to open up a wide range of services. But now you're asking a special education teacher who's supposed to serve 13 different types of disabilities to teach your child the science of reading when they're dealing with attention problems, when they're dealing, they have to pull the kids out to put them in a room for 20 minutes to teach them how they're supposed to learn. That is nearly impossible. And Emily Hanford's work, which we all know is some of the best education reporting out there, is she found that 4 out of 10 pre-service teacher training programs don't teach phonics and the science of reading. So that now that means if I get a special education teacher, the chances of them knowing the science of reading to teach my child how to read is small, right? And the way that I saw response to intervention working, meaning he needs some help, but we're not going to exactly qualify him for a reading interventionist yet. It's just a way of delaying the children getting the help they need. And so with budgets extremely constrained, they don't give the teachers, the administration doesn't give the teachers the support they need to have the credits and the training they need in the science of reading. And so I'm barely getting what I need for my third grader learning to read. And, you know, I think that's a tragedy.
So, Mickey, what is the solution to all of this? I mean, this is quite depressing.
Yeah. Sorry, you know, for your listeners.
a parent listening to this will understand it, will relate with their child. And do you know what? This is an issue whether your child has mild dyslexia, moderate dyslexia, or extreme dyslexia. And sometimes, actually, to be honest, you're better off with extreme dyslexia because the problem presents itself so dramatically. With moderate to mild dyslexia, you still have all the downsides, but it rumbles. And it, anyway, I'm yeah. getting onto my pet thing, which is stealth dyslexia and how huge impact it's having on our society. What's the solution that you can see for listeners?
Yes. So I can give the solutions back through the problems, right? So because we're underfunded, the thing that you should do, write your congressman, make a meeting with your congressman, speak up to your congressman, and tell them to fully fund IDEA. We have every 2 years, depending on what house of government we're in, we have, and November is a critical moment. So speak up to try to get IDEA funded. I'm part of an education group in Jersey City, and we asked for transparency of funding. So we got a special education audit so we can see where every dollar is being spent and how it shouldn't be spent on a crossing guard, but should be spent to train a teacher. So look for the transparency of funding. For early intervention, the second that you see something, speak up, because the mother's instincts are always right, and father's too. And so, you know, if you see some of the clear signs, which you've talked about on your other, you know, episodes, please speak to your pediatrician. There's screeners that you can do now online, self-screeners that you can use to speak up and try your best to get your child the help they need early. And finally, on teacher training, I'm always believe you should be your teacher's ally. We always started the school year. One of the women in our book, she wrote the most amazing letter. She welcomed the teacher back to school, and she printed out all of the accommodations that her son needed just so that it got to the school ahead of the paperwork. So she greeted herself. She let her introduced her son and told the teacher that he can self-advocate for herself. And here's what he needed. I thought that was a brilliant idea. Like, make friends with your teacher, go and speak about the accommodations that you need, substitute teach so they can get the training that they need if you have to. Put them in mind mapping classes, like do whatever that you can to help support them. And then I also in the book talk about alternative schools. So I visited a charter school in Staten Island that's only for dyslexic kids. So public funding, amazing options. The results you see coming out of there are fascinating. I talked to a micro school in Arizona who built a dyslexic curriculum because they saw so many students coming to them wanting to have this like child-led curiosity way. And then I also spoke to a school in Portland, Oregon about direct instruction. So there's so many different ways that exist outside of traditional schools. And I actually think that COVID is going to, you know, start to spawn some of the great resources that are out there as well. Dyslexic children, as you know, need structure, and wherever you can find it, please find your way.
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about the book. You cover a lot of these in the book then.
Yes, I do. So the book is called One in Five, How We're Fighting for Our Dyslexic Children in a System That's Failing Them. And you can find it on any online retailer, Amazon, wherever you are globally. It came out on August 11th. You can just search up my name, Mickey Bowis, and you should be able to find One in Five.
And is it on audio, by the way, for
it
us
is.
Dyslexics?
I actually, before I signed the book deal, I said, I will not do this deal if I cannot have an audio book because
oh, fantastic.
I cannot get through 282 pages. So I narrate the first few pages, and then I have an amazing woman who helped me. And it's a short 9 hours, but as we're all sitting in our houses right now, you know, while you're cooking, you can have it on. The greatest gift I've had is to have my son read it with me. Oh, it's been so beautiful.
That's great. That's great. Well, I mean, a short 9 hours, I normally listen at 4 speed, so that'll be done in a couple of hours.
I just wanted to tell people that, so outside of the book, I just created this place for content and who knows what comes out of it, but it's called theinvisibleredtape.com. So kind of like a thought leadership forum where I'll put, you know, press and I'll put like if this is made into who knows what after it. But it was actually the original name for the book, Invisible Red Tape. And so I got the site invisibleredtape.com. So for people who want to stay updated on what's going on, that's the best place to find me.
Fantastic. I love that invisible red tape. I love that picture of you think it's going to be a red carpet, but ends up being a blizzard of red tape.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens, I think, with everyone with a child with special needs. And one of my favorite lines in the book is it threatens to wrap itself around us and mummify us to keep us quiet until we're silent. And so I just want people to be able to cut through it and know that there's hope and there's change and there's ways to find your way out.
Mickey, thank you very much for sharing your journey on this podcast. And what we'll do is we'll put the links into the show notes, the different resources into the show notes, so people can go link to the book, a link to everything that you've referenced. And we're also doing a little map about this, a mind map, animated mind map to summarize this talk as well. So we'll put that link in here as well.
I see it happening on the screen over there.
Okay. So Mickey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me and giving the opportunity to tell everyone's story.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.